It's the Burt Cohen Show. Never a lack of history being made. Egypt, my goodness, it's a confusing, terribly bloody situation. We're going to look at that in the first part of the program, then look at the militarization of police on the second half of the Burt Cohen Show. Our first guest is Phyllis Bennis, who directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Thank you, Phyllis, for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show.
Great to be with you.
And there was she covers the Middle East. She's been an advisor to several top UN officials on the Middle East. She's been involved with the campaign to end Israeli occupation and works closely with United for Peace and Justice anti-war coalition. There was tremendous excitement filling the streets of Cairo in July 2013 as the Muslim Brotherhood's president, Morsi, was removed from office. Back then, the crowds were very enthusiastic. It looked like a wonderful place to be. The crowds welcomed the military to get Morsi out of office. Now, with the tremendous violence in which hundreds have been killed, do you have any sense of how the Egyptians now regard their military?
Well, I think there's a huge divide in Egypt, and it's getting wider and wider. Certainly, the supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood, supporters of ousted President Morsi, and the others around that arena are outraged at what happened. But increasingly, it isn't only supporters of Morsi who are outraged. It's also people who are outraged at the complete overthrow of democracy as flawed and insufficient and bad in so many ways that the initial democratic trajectory was in Egypt after the overthrow of Hosni Mubarak back in January of 2011. A lot of people, I think, somewhat naively, thought, well, we'll just do it again. We'll go into the streets again. We'll put enough pressure on again so the military will come back again and overthrow this guy, too, because we don't like him. He's been in power for a year, and he hasn't done anything right. He hasn't improved the economy. He's made a lot of big mistakes in terms of consolidating too much power around the Brotherhood, etc. We'll just get rid of him, not taking into account the consequences when you enable and empower and endorse a military coup on your own. You're really saying that the military then gets to decide what they're going to do. And what they've done has been to reassert the kind of military dictatorship that was in power in Egypt for more than 30 years under Mubarak and his predecessor, led and supported and propped up and paid for by the United States. And according to many Egyptians now, it's actually worse in terms of human rights violations, the empowerment of the police and the security forces. It's a horrific situation. And I think more and more people are turning away from the military. Saying that, however, should not indicate that there's not an enormous number of Egyptians who are happy that the Muslim Brotherhood has had many people killed, that the leaders of the Brotherhood have been arrested. Just this morning, the spiritual leader of the Brotherhood was arrested. The killing of 36, perhaps more, but at least 36 Brotherhood supporters who were killed brutally by the military day before yesterday, already in custody,
yes,
killed by a combination of tear gas and torture, it emerges. There's an awful lot of people that think that's kind of fine because the alternative for them was unacceptable to have the Brotherhood in the center of power. So it's a very divided country. It means that things are going, in my view, to get much worse before they get better. And I think that we're in for a very rough ride in Egypt.
Do you think that there's any possibility it will not become a civil war?
Yes, I think that civil war, as we understand it, in terms of real militarized forces on both sides, is not likely. The reasons being, number one, there's no armed population to go against the army. This is a one-sided armed situation. This is not like either Libya or Syria, where the armed opposition began with defecting soldiers.
Right.
High-level and low-level defecting with their weapons. They became the core of the military opposition. We're not seeing that in Egypt, partly because in Egypt, historically, the military has been a major economic and social player in the country, in the sense that they control about 35% of the economy, they control about 40% of the economy, uh-huh. about 30 to 35% of the arable land, they control major industries.
Hmm.
So the military people are very privileged,
yeah.
and as a result, they're in there fighting to defend their privilege. They're very unlikely to defect in significant numbers. Secondly, I think that what we're seeing, I think that there is the danger that there will be armed attacks that will increase. I think some of the Brotherhood is likely to be forced underground. Some of them may take up arms and reject their longstanding decision to give up military struggle. I'm assuming that. I have no inside information, but I think that's unfortunately a likely possibility. But that's a far cry from an actual civil war.
Uh-huh. We're talking on the Bert Cohen Show with Phyllis Bennis, New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, very familiar with the Middle East for a long, long time. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood, it does seem, it certainly appears, that one of the goals of the military was to crush the Muslim Brotherhood, to just wipe them out entirely. They had a lot of power. They've
Absolutely.
Been underground for a long time. But my very limited understanding of the Egyptian people, aren't martyrs kind of useful? And isn't it likely that though the intent was to crush the Muslim Brotherhood, that this will in fact fire them up and make them even stronger?
Absolutely. Ironically, that's one of the things that Senator McCain, of all people, said to the military leadership just before the attack on the camps when he was in Cairo, or at least he claims he said it, that he told them, right now, everybody thinks that the Brotherhood did a really terrible job when they held
right.
the presidency.
Right.
If you kill them all and attack them all, they're going to be martyrs.
Right.
And that is, in fact, what's happening. That's presumably part of the reason. I don't think it's the only reason, but I think that's part of the reason that the military is quickly losing support from large numbers of Egyptians. I mean, there was a horrific story just a few hours ago. It broke that Mohammed al-Baradei, who had been had called for the military intervention, had been the vice president in the military-appointed so-called interim government,
mm-hmm.
in what many saw as a real betrayal of his long-standing commitment to democratic change. He then broke with the military and resigned his position as vice president, saying that he could not support the military actions. He's just been arrested and charged with undermining state action or something like that.
Oh, my goodness.
And he's now in prison.
Well, there was this huge outpouring back in the Arab Spring, the 2011 revolution, and it looked like people power was unstoppable. Is what we're seeing now a repudiation of that revolution? And what about all those hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people out on the streets? Do they have no power? I mean, are they just going to surrender their power to the military?
Well, that's part of the problem of what we've seen. I think that what was forgotten was that the massive, extraordinary, exciting,
yes.
earth-shattering developments of Tahrir Square and the Arab Spring 2.5 years ago that brought millions of people into the street, millions of people into political engagement for the first time. Egyptians, like Tunisians and others, claimed their rights as citizens for the first time after living for so many decades as subjects of a dictatorship. This was all an incredibly exciting empowering set of developments, and what people forgot was that at the end of the day, it wasn't people power by itself that deposed a dictator. It was the military making a judgment that their interests were better served without Mubarak. And they stopped backing him. And that's what forced him out of office. He was ultimately a military dictator. He was backed by the military. He was himself a general. And when the military said, we no longer can support him, that's what led to it. So it was a military coup, in a sense, except that it wasn't really a coup because it wasn't against an elected, democratically elected leader. It was against an imposed military dictator.
Mubarak,
this time around, it was a real coup that deposed a democratically elected, freely elected popular leader who had done a terrible job and probably should have been either recalled in another constitutional form if they developed a recall, or certainly voted out of office in three more years.
And I
when the military comes in and overthrows him, that's a coup.
I wonder what happens to the people now. I would think that, you know, a few hundred people getting murdered, you know, shot from roofs, you know, just specifically shot in the face even, that would be kind of a disincentive to come out on the streets and to demand, you know, a change in government. The population now that's neither with Morsi but is really concerned about a military dictatorship, there must be a lot of them, but will they have some degree of power now, or do you think they...
It's not clear. They're not coming out visibly in the streets, partly for, I think, the reasons you just say, partly because there's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of confusion. The people who are in the streets protesting against the dictatorship now, against the military, are what is known as the Coalition for Legitimacy, which has the Brotherhood at its core, but is already much wider than that. It includes other political forces. The break within the anti-Morsi forces have been quite astonishing. You know, the April 6th movement, which was one of the very important youth movements that had taken their formation from the trade union activism over the last decade or more and had created one of the key organizations that was part of the Arab Spring, they were part of the group that called for the overthrow of Morsi, called for the soldiers and the military to intervene, but they pulled back, and they no longer support it. There are reports that even within Tamarud, the organization called Rebel, that led to the petition drive that was key in the anti-Morsi mobilization, that part of their leadership, at least, maybe more, has come out against what the military is doing. So I think as the military consolidates, you're going to see more and more opposition. The challenge now, I think, for people in Egypt is that while they have seen and tasted what popular power, what democratic power can look like, what the rights of citizenship can lead to, they also have enabled the return of an incredibly tight dictatorship that is going to exact an enormous price for the exercise of that power again. So where they fit now, will they go forward again and challenge the dictatorship again with all the risks that we see?
Right.
Or will they be forced back into the position of subjects no longer be able to be acting on their own destiny?
And the economy has been just terrible, and that's got to be a significant motivating force. I mean, that's really...
Absolutely. The economy is disastrous. It's gotten no better since it was such a big part of why people went into the streets 2.5 years ago. Morsi made a number of economic mistakes, although it's not clear how much leeway he actually had, but where he did have leeway, he pretty much made the wrong decision across the board. But the economy is a disaster. It's only going to get worse. A huge percentage of the economy of Egypt comes from tourism. And, of course, in a situation like this, tourism has tanked. There are no tourists in Egypt right now.
Well, imagine you could get hotel rooms pretty cheap.
I bet you could.
Where, if you just tuned into the Bert Cohen Show.
Great time to go out to see the pyramids.
Our guest is Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, an analyst very familiar with the Middle East, and we're talking about the situation in Egypt. And what about the outside influence on the domestic situation? We read that the Saudi royals have now declared their strong financial backing for the military. How is that going to play?
Well, the U.S. has done that, too. The U.S. Is really trying to play a kind of divided game. The U.S. provides $1.5 billion a year to Egypt, of which $1.3 billion, so practically all of it goes directly to the military, mm-hmm. and ultimately comes directly back to U.S. military corporations. So it's a very nice thing. It's essentially corporate welfare for the war profiteers in this country. And the Egyptian generals get the toys. The boys get their toys. The Saudis have announced, as you mentioned, and this happened actually even before the U.S. even considered holding back part of the aid, which is what they're saying now, that they're considering delaying consideration of the last $500 million that remains. It's about a quarter of the aid of this year that hasn't been sent already. They're considering whether they might delay that. But even before that rather flimsy announcement, the Saudis had put together a $12 billion package, which included $8 billion from Saudi Arabia, $4 billion from Kuwait, and $3 billion from the United Arab Emirates, and said, here you go, no strings attached, do what you want with it. So the U.S. funding becomes much less important. Right. That becomes kind of chump change.
Right.
What does remain important in terms of U.S. influence, which there's no indication the Obama administration or the Pentagon are prepared to use, is the fact that all of the military's equipment, their planes, their tanks, their bullets, their guns, their rifles, their rockets, everything, come from the United States, which means it's U.S. licensed military equipment, and they need more ammunition, they need assistance in maintenance contracts, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. That's where the U.S. could say, we're not concerned about where the money comes from, we're not going to fix any more of your rifles because we don't like how you're using them. That's the pressure the U.S. could bring to bear. But the question of Israel looms very large. There's no particular reason it should. Neither the military nor the Morsi government, for that matter, showed any indication that they have any interest in undermining the existing collaboration with the Israeli military that both have continued to carry out. The U.S., of course, is also concerned about our privileged position vis-a-vis the Suez Canal. U.S. warships are allowed to jump to the head of the line in that very congested sea lane, and our privileged access to Egyptian airspace in the context of the so-called global war on terror.
Right.
If the U.S. lost those things, they would be much more difficult for them to wage their drone war in places like Yemen and Pakistan and Afghanistan and elsewhere.
Well, I would think that the state of Israel might prefer not to have the Muslim Brotherhood, because I would think the Muslim Brotherhood would be not as cozy with the state of Israel as other forms of government.
Well, you'd think that. But in fact, the military under Morsi was collaborating very nicely with the Israeli military. They cooperated on making sure that the Gaza crossings largely remained closed. For all of the initial propaganda about the political ties between the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas in Gaza, it didn't help. The Rafah crossing, which was the only real lifeline of Palestinians in Gaza to get goods and services in, to get people in and out, to get medical help, those crossings have been closed. And now they're closed absolutely. I think the Israelis are right to think that the military in power directly is more reliable for their interests than the military having to operate through the Muslim Brotherhood-led government. But they did an okay job through that government, too.
Interesting. Well, normally, I know you only have a couple of minutes, but normally when it comes to world affairs and foreign policy, normally it's fairly clear which side, pro-Palestinian American lefties should be on. But I think a lot of people on the left in America are really confused. What any clue on this? Is there a clear side?
I think the bottom line is we can't always be looking for counterparts,
What do you mean?
For me, I look at the question of rights, human rights, international law, equality. Those are the things that I try to base my politics on. And I see the government in Egypt being a fake government designed to provide a fig leaf to the military, a military that is repressing a huge proportion of the people of Egypt. Now, do I like the idea of a more Islamist-flavored government? No, I'm a pretty secular girl. I wouldn't want to live under it. But it's not my country.
Exactly.
I don't get to live there.
I know.
I mean, I could if I wanted to, I suppose, but I don't live there. So I don't get to say, I think they should have a very secular government. Many Egyptians want a secular government, but many Egyptians also want a government that takes up more of the Islamic rules. I don't like that idea, but that's a political struggle that secular Egyptians are going to have to wage. When they wage it by calling in the military to overthrow an elected government, I can't support that. Yeah. That's a coup d'etat, and I've never liked coup d'etats because whether you call it a coup or not, at the end of the day, when the military is in control, the people are the ones who suffer.
Interesting. If you have time for one, but what if you were making U.S. policy, what would you suggest? What can the U.S. do? What should the U.S. do?
I think the first thing is to say we're cutting off aid to the military because they carried out a military coup. We are going to urge all parties to stop this kind of repression, and we're going to impose the Leahy laws that say we will not support any military or police agency that carries out consistent human rights violations. I would say that we're going to change our policy in the rest of the region to match that. It's not about only doing the right thing in Egypt when we've done the wrong thing for so many years. Sure. We've got to change our policy towards Israel, end support for the occupation, end the military aid there, and build a policy that's based on international law, human rights, and equality for all.
Now, I think that would work selfishly as well for the U.S. interest. Phyllis Bennis, thank you so much for being with us. If people are interested in following your work, is there a website to which you can point listeners?
The IPS website is ips-dc.org.
ips-dc.org. Thanks so much for being with us on the Bert
Cohen
Show.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. The situation in Egypt. That, of course, was the clash. Bert Cohen here. We'll switch gears a little bit. Talk about the militarization of America's police forces. Have you noticed it? Boy, I sure have. There sure seems to be a very big change. Maybe something can be done about it. We will see. Our guest on the second half of the Bert Cohen Show is Radley Balko, senior writer and investigative reporter for The Huffington Post, where he covers civil liberties and the criminal justice system. Radley, thanks for being with us on the Bert Cohen Show.
My pleasure.
And your new book is called Rise of the Warrior Cop. Rise of the Warrior Cop, the Militarization of America's Police Forces. And there's a new article on the Huffington Post drawing down how to roll back police militarization in America. Again, thanks for being with us, Radley. First, let's look at the state of the police state. I wonder if we could compare the use, just start off perhaps comparing the use of SWAT teams and other paramilitary tactics now in 2013 as compared to 20 or so years ago. Has the goal remained the same, to catch dangerous, violent offenders? So what is the difference between the use of SWAT teams, say, in the 1980s versus now?
Well, I guess first is just the frequency. In the late 1970s, there were a few hundred SWAT team deployments per year. by the early 1980s, we were up to about a few thousand. And by 2005, which is the last year that the criminologist who has been surveying this trend did his follow-up study, it was up to about 50,000 per year. So from a few hundred in the 70s to 50,000 per year in 2005. The other real change, I think, is in how and why they're being used. And SWAT teams were basically sort of invented, I guess, late 1960s. And until the early 80s, they were primarily used in emergency-type situations where you were using this form of government violence to diffuse an already violent situation. You used SWAT teams when lives were at risk, and you were using them to try to save those lives. What we see in the early 1980s, and really until continuing today, is an increasing willingness to use these kinds of tactics as an investigative tool to send SWAT teams into people's homes to serve drug warrants on people suspected of, or serve search warrants, I'm sorry, on people suspected of nonviolent consensual crimes, mostly drug crimes. And, you know, this started in the 80s with a lot of drug war hysteria, and the justification was that drug dealers are, you know, hardened criminals, well-armed, wouldn't think twice before, you know, killing police officers. And, you know, there are a lot of counter arguments to that. Not all of that is true. A lot of it was, you know, just based on a lot of the drug war hype and drug war hysteria at the time. But then we see two real changes even to that, where we move into even newer, more troubling territory. The first is in 1996 when California legalizes medical marijuana, and several states then follow suit. And the federal government responds by sending SWAT teams into these medical marijuana clinics and dispensaries. And, you know, now you can no longer argue that, you know, these people are a threat to police officers or to federal officers in this case. You know, these are businesses that were openly operating, that had business licenses, were operating in compliance with state law, but they were flouting federal law, and so the federal government was basically using violence against them to send a political message, basically to make examples of them. And that's really, I would say, you know, terrifying new ground, really. I mean, this is not, the use of violence to make a political statement is not usually something we associate with the principles of a free society. And then the second sort of new territory, or I guess new frontier in the use of this kind of force, has really come in the last, I would say, 6 or 7 years, where we've seen SWAT teams get a little bit of mission creep, or actually a lot of mission creep, where they're being used to enforce regulatory law. They're being used, you know, to raid neighborhood poker games, you know, to raid bars where they suspect underage drinking is going on. And so we've reached the point, really, to where, you know, this level of force and this level of government violence that was once reserved as a last resort when lives were at immediate risk is today used too often as a first resort when there's really no threat, you know, no dangerous imminent threat at all.
So, Radley, you're saying that the raids on the legitimate state-licensed medical marijuana businesses, those have been like violent raids, like SWAT team raids, really?
Oh, sure. There were lots of stories about this when they started in the mid to late 90s of these federal SWAT teams coming in and, you know, raiding these dispensaries. And, you know, some of them were, you know, certainly questionably legitimate, you know, in the way they were dispensing marijuana. But of course some of them were legitimate. They were dispensing to, you know, cancer and AIDS patients.
Sure.
But regardless, they were legal, and they were operating openly. And, you know, whether or not, even if they were dispensing marijuana in violation of federal law, which most of them were,
sure,
you can handle that in ways other than sending a SWAT team in. And SWAT team was overkill for a reason. It was to make an example of them. And it still happens today.
And they want to make an example. The officers carrying it out, you know, they don't make policy, I wouldn't think. But where is this direction coming from that, that they have to make an example? You know, are they just like, we have to, is it as simple as saying, hey, we're the federal government, you guys at the state level, even though you make your own laws and you have your own police, we, you know, are on top of it. We're the heavies here. I mean, is it that simple? I mean, what, sure. What's the purpose of that?
Well, I mean, it comes from the DEA, and it comes from the people who supervise the DEA, which would be the Attorney General and the President. And you know, I mean, and there was a kind of a constitutional crisis going on in the late '90s, and actually, it was really continued until today, even with you know Colorado and Washington legalizing marijuana. You know, it's about asserting federal power. You know, these states were that had legalized the drug for medical purposes were openly challenging federal power. And if you, you know, I think the thinking in the Clinton administration and then every administration since, was that if you let this happen, then, you know, states might begin to question the legitimacy of federal power in other areas. So you had to crack down on it, immediately. And I'll say it's only gotten worse. I mean, the Obama administration has actually conducted more medical marijuana raids in 4.5 years than the Bush administration did in 8. So it's not, you know, it's actually
bipartisan.
Getting worse. It's not getting better.
Amazing. If you just tuned in to the Burt Cohen Show, our guest right now is Radley Balko, senior writer and investigative reporter for the Huffington Post. He's written a book called The Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces. And you know, if people, I've heard it said that if your only tool is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Since September 11, 2001, the federal government has handed out some $34 billion in grants to police departments across the country. What has that money been used for? Do the local police get to say what they want, or is it the federal government that's making the decisions as to, you know, here's the tools you guys can have, this is it, take it or leave it? Well, not even leave it, you just have to take it. How does that work?
Part of the problem is these grants that are coming through the Department of Homeland Security are, you know, ostensibly anti-terrorism grants. And so these local police departments apply for these grants to buy things like armored personnel carriers, heavy guns and helicopters and tanks and that sort of thing. But the problem is, of course, you know, they're going to police departments everywhere, and they're going to police departments in places that are never going to be hit with a terrorist attack. Right. And so then once these departments in places like, you know, Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, or Tuscaloosa, Alabama, get this equipment, and inevitably they don't succumb to Al-Qaeda, then the equipment gets used. You know, you have it, you want to use it, so it gets used in more mundane policing, and that usually means drug raids. You know, it also gets trotted out for parades and public events and that kind of thing, but, you know, once they have it, they want to use it, and the most, you know, kind of routine way to use this kind of equipment is the service of drug warrants. And I would add, too, that serving drug warrants also comes with federal grants that are tied just to drug policing and also civil asset forfeiture. So, you know, using this equipment in drug raids can actually generate revenue for the police department.
And I thought it was interesting here in New Hampshire, where the show originates, there was a tank, a personnel carrier, and what was cited was somewhat radical political groups. It's something called the Free State Project, which is pretty minimal, and the Occupy people. They're not exactly Al-Qaeda fronts, but that is more than a little bit scary if these things can come up.
I mean, both of these groups are nonviolent. I mean, I guess there have been a few incidents of violence that's Occupy protests, but that's been, you know, both spurred on by the police, and to the extent that there were some violent incidents inspired by or carried out by Occupy protesters, they were, you know, isolated.
So
overwhelmingly a peaceful movement. And the Free State Project is a completely, you know, peaceful movement. I mean, these are libertarians, and non-aggression is sort of at the center of their entire political philosophy. So the idea that a police department would cite these two groups as a reason for needing an armored personnel carrier, I think just, you know, demonstrates just how, you know, conditioned police agencies are today to see any form of protest or any kind of, you know, objection or exercise of rights, as a threat, to government officials. I think it really demonstrates kind of paranoia, that we're seeing, in a lot of police agencies today. And that really, I think, is, what's driving this desire to be well armed and to use increasingly aggressive tactics.
Yeah, it's interesting. Many of us who lived through the 60s and 70s thought we sort of had finished with executive paranoia when Nixon left, but it seems to have spread beyond just the presidency into thinking that violence has to be applied. And I had a professor in college who defined politics as the economy of violence. When you see,
I'm a libertarian, so I would define that the same way. I mean, I think politics is basically factions fighting over, who gets to use legitimized violence to enforce their policy on the rest of the country.
That seems to be the case. And you brought up, Radley, you brought up the civil asset forfeiture programs. How does that affect the militarization police? Is that an incentive for more raids? And maybe you could, not everybody is familiar with the civil asset forfeiture program.
Yeah, so civil asset forfeiture is this absurd legal principle that property can be guilty of a crime. And, it used to be that, the idea of asset forfeiture dates back centuries, and it's the idea of ill-gotten gains, that criminals shouldn't be able to profit from their crimes. And that makes perfect sense when, you've actually convicted someone of a crime and then you take their property, the property that they've earned, from criminal enterprise. The problem with civil asset forfeiture is, it says the property is guilty of the crime. Therefore, if the police can make any sort of connection between your money or your car or your house, and drug activity, they get to take it. And then you have to go to court and basically prove that you own that property legitimately, which, as you might imagine, in a lot of cases is impossible. The thing about civil asset forfeiture is they never even need to charge you with a crime, much less convict you, to take your property away. And so they can, and the money then goes back to the police department, which of course creates some really perverse incentives. And in fact, most of the people, about 75 to 80% of the people who lose property under civil asset forfeiture are never charged with any actual crime. To make matters even worse, most of the property confiscated under this policy is relatively low
value.
Worth relatively little money, usually under $50,000. In fact, in most cases, it would cost you more money to go to court to win it back than the property is actually worth. Which, of course, again, is a crazy sort of catch-22 situation. So the way this applies to these raids is that these civil asset forfeiture is overwhelmingly used in drug crimes because it's the easiest sort of crime to link property to some sort of criminal activity. And so it provides this strong incentive. And again, these SWAT teams are, this equipment is expensive to maintain. Ideally, you want your SWAT team to be well-trained, which costs money. And so you have the SWAT team, and you can either, keep it in mothballs until you get one of these, legitimately dangerous situations that SWAT teams are appropriate for, like an active shooter or violent fugitive on the loose. Or you can start sending your SWAT team out on drug raids. And again, with civil asset forfeiture and with these anti-drug grants, these raids can actually generate money for your police department instead of costing the police department money.
Wow. Yeah, that's largely what it's about, isn't it? Making money, where the money comes from. A lot of money comes from the Pentagon programs, the giveaway surplus military equipment, a lot of money from the federal government for Homeland Security. Love that phrase. It sounds so 1984-ish. One of the things that has happened is police drills in schools where they send, heavily armed police officers, usually, quite frankly, fairly disorganized, into the schools and scare the, out of kids and teachers. What is going on with that? Is that coming at us from the federal level?
I don't know that that is. I mean, there may be some federal programs that, encourage that kind of school programming, but I think a lot of it's at the local level. You can actually trace a lot of this back to a lot of the anti-drunk driving campaigns where there was this idea that it was perfectly appropriate to scare, the hell out of students. I remember one program I read about a couple of years ago where they called a school-wide meeting and announced that three of the students' classmates had been killed in a drunk driving accident, and students were, grieving and, just terribly upset all day, and at the end of the day, they revealed that it was all sort of theatrics to illustrate the dangers of drunk driving, and, you know, these three kids are fine. And, I mean, you see this kind of thing going on now, that the only, you know, you have to scare kids in order to, I don't know.
Well,
I mean, actually, in these SWAT cases, they're not even really teaching them anything. I mean, these are drills basically to, I don't know, to train the cops, and just kind of using students as
using students, yes,
you know, as dummies, crash test dummies, I guess, sure, for lack of a better term.
Right, and I wonder about, you know, what that is teaching. Doesn't that serve to legitimize heavy, you know, militarized police presence, if we can expect him at any moment, at a whim, to go into our schools, and that be legitimate? You know, that's fairly intense. And, you know, I got to tell you, it used to be understood that the police were there to serve the common good. They worked on our behalf, we the people. My sense is that it's transformed into an us against them, us being the people, being them, the cops being the us, into that mode of action by the police. Some have referred to overgrown child bullies. You know, back in the 50s, these thugs were, you know, a small part of the equation in terms of the police force. But I wonder about now, the good cops, the cops who, you know, really, and there are a lot of them, they do want to serve the common good. But I wonder if, you know, the ratio has changed between, you know, cops that are out there to serve the public and to do what they're supposed to do versus what some have called overgrown child bullies or thugs.
Well, I think you have to look again at incentives, and incentives matter. And, you know, the idea is that there's, I mean, if you look at, I'll give you one example. If you look at the recruiting videos that police departments send out to high schools and colleges across the country, you can find a lot of them on YouTube. The videos are overwhelmingly stressing, you know, the images in the videos are things like cops kicking down doors and shooting people and tackling people and, you know, rappelling out of helicopters. It's set to heavy metal music. And, I mean, this is the very first step in the process, right? These are the videos that they're sending out to get people interested in becoming law enforcement officers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you think back to the people you went to high school or college with and think about the, you know, your classmates who would have watched a video like that and thought, that's what I want to do for a living,
yeah,
I think you'll probably conclude that those are some of the last people that you would want to be police officers. I mean, there's no, you know, and it's not all the videos. They're disturbingly right. High percentage of them. There's no, you know, there's no stressing of community service or this aspect of, you know, civil service. It's all about, you know, kicking butt and taking names, basically. And, you know, if that's the, you know, the personality types that you're recruiting into the department at the very first stage, you know, you can only imagine, you know, where it's going to go from there.
Absolutely. If you just tuned in to the Burt Cohen Show, our guest on this half hour is Radley Balko, senior writer, investigative reporter for the Huffington Post. We're talking about how to roll back police militarization in America. And let's look at perhaps what can be done at the state, maybe local, certainly the federal level. And I believe in 2008, Maryland set an example in legislation to mandate transparency. I wonder if you could tell us about that, please, Radley.
Yeah, well, this was a very simple, straightforward bill. It didn't put any restrictions on SWAT teams or on police departments. You know, it wasn't really even put no regulations on them. All it said is that any police department in the state that has one of these SWAT teams or SWAT-like teams has to issue a twice-yearly report to the state attorney general's office on how often they use their SWAT team, what they use it for, what was found during the raid, whether any shots were fired during the raid, and a few other, you know, different categories of data. And, you know, it's been enormously helpful. I mean, one thing I found in writing about this issue was that, you know, there's a professor, Peter Kraska, the criminologist who gave us the numbers I threw out at the beginning of our talk, you know, he did the surveys, but they were samples, and he stopped in 2005. And other than that, there's really no data out there. And so you can't even really do a cost-benefit analysis because the information just isn't there. And, you know, the Maryland bill has shown us that just in the state of Maryland alone, there are about 4.5 SWAT raids per day, and that the overwhelming majority of them are for low-level drug crimes, but that is mostly why SWAT teams are used in Maryland. And, you know, that's sort of confirms what a lot of us had suspected, a lot of us critics had suspected. But that is at least a starting point, you know, where we can start to actually have a public policy discussion now about whether, you know, this kind of force is being used appropriately. I will say that, you know, I think every state should have a bill like this at minimum. I mean, it's just transparency. And I will say that in Maryland, it was opposed by every police agency in the state. Just minimal transparency. And, you know, they fought tooth and nail to prevent that, even that from happening.
Well, I do notice that when it comes to municipal budgets, it's very, very challenging for any elected official to even have any shred of criticism about the police budget. Generally, they get whatever they want, and there's a certain element of fear. And
well, I would,
yeah, go ahead.
I would push back just a little bit on that. I think you're right in a lot of respects, but you know, there have been cases where you know the money just isn't there. And what we see happen then is when federal or when public officials, mayors and city and town councils are negotiating with police unions and the money isn't there, what ends up happening is they, you know, if they can't give more overtime or higher pay or, you know, better benefits, what they will do is give them less accountability and make it more difficult to fire police officers, give them more job protections, you know, make it so that even if an officer does get fired, he can easily find another job in, you know, another department without his reputation following him. So, you know, I think you're right that it is very, very difficult for politicians to ever say, you know, maybe police need to be more accountable, maybe there need to be a little more restrictions on use of force. But, you know, the way that plays out is even when, on those rare occasions when they don't get what they want in the budget, they get accommodations and less accountability.
Oh, interesting. And on the subject of transparency, which is very important, police oftentimes video record their actions, but it's not clear if the citizens have the same right. I've been rather amazed at the discrepancy there. I wonder how realistic it would be to require video recording of all raids and to make them available to, you know, the people that they allegedly work for, the, you know, the elected officials.
It would be very easy, actually. I mean, the way the advances of technology mean you could, it would be very easy and relatively inexpensive to put a camera on every SWAT officer's uniform and archive that video in a way that can't be tampered with, and then to make that make those videos accessible through state open records laws. This would not be difficult at all to do. On your first point, I would say I would emphasize that to your listeners that it is legal in every state in the country to record police officers. It is absolutely legal. You cannot be convicted of, you know, wiretapping or eavesdropping or violating privacy. Every court to date, every court in the country that has ruled on this has ruled that there is a First Amendment right to record on-duty cops. I will say this, police officers will still, in some places, try to arrest you. And, you know, they'll claim that you are interfering with them or, you know, they may even arrest you wrongly on these wiretapping charges. And, you know, you could spend a night in jail. And probably they'll take your phone and probably delete the videos. But ultimately the charges will be dropped. And, you know, maybe you can file a lawsuit. But I mean, it's important to stress that, it is, as long as you're not physically interfering with a police officer, it is perfectly legal to record, an on-duty cop. And, you know, what would be great to see is if legislatures would pass laws, providing a cause of action for people who are illegally arrested so that, you know, the message is reinforced at police agencies. But, you know, right now you simply cannot be convicted for recording a cop unless you physically interfere with them.
Interesting. So there are tools, you know, people can press their legislators. It seems in America, people believe more than other places that we don't have power to make change, but we do. We absolutely do. And if a legislator hears from somebody, they'll figure there's a lot of other people who feel the same way. And if you have examples of other laws that they can model in your state, like take the Maryland, you know, case and just see if that can be replicated, there are things that that people can do. What about, you know, what can be done at the federal level? You mentioned ending federal incentives for mass police militarization. Tell us about that. What would that look like?
Well, I think we just need to end these grants, these burn grants, they're called, that go just to drug policing, that, you know, police departments don't get federal money for arresting, you know, suspected murderers or suspected rapists. They do get money for arresting suspected drug offenders.
Oh.
And that really warps the priorities of these police departments and what sort of resources they devote, you know, to which class of crimes. So just ending these that program in itself would go a long way. Also, the high-intensity drug traffic area program is a program where if your police department makes so many drug arrests in a given time period, you get classified as a high-intensity drug area, which comes with a bunch of federal money. Now, if you think about how that plays out in reality, it becomes a strong incentive for you to send your cops out, if you're a police chief, and make as many drug arrests as possible in that period of time in order to qualify for this funding so that you get, you know, an infusion of federal dollars. So that program provides perverse incentives that should be ended. I think, you know, giving surplus military equipment away to police departments, as the Pentagon's been doing for 30 years, it's an awful idea. I mean, this is equipment that was designed for use on a battlefield. It was designed to be used to annihilate a foreign enemy, and it's being used on American streets and in American neighborhoods.
Wow. Yeah, this is not a war zone here, but although, you know, it does seem like the war on drugs, you know, oftentimes it seems like the incentives are there to fight the drug war as if it were an actual war. And that's pretty dangerous stuff. So I would think, Radley, you would suggest that one of the ways we can demilitarize the police is to, you know, make some real changes on this incredibly expensive, totally failed war on drugs.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I think the federal drug war, actually, I think I would end the drug war completely tomorrow if it were up to me.
Yes.
And certainly end the federal drug war. But, you know, obviously those are, neither of those things are going to happen anytime soon. So I do think, you know, it may be good to focus efforts on working, you know, within the framework of the idea that, you know, we're going to continue to have drug prohibition in the near future.
Well, we'll see about that. I think the tide is changing. We'll see how fast it does. And, you know, we, the people, we want to be safe. We want our police to serve us and to keep our communities safe. And I wonder in what ways, if any, money might be being drained away from conventional law enforcement. Is that the case? Is money being wasted on stuff that doesn't really protect us?
So, well, certainly. I mean, I would argue that any time you're sending, you know, SWAT teams out or any actually police officer that's dedicating, you know, all of his or her time to, investigating and policing nonviolent consensual crimes is not really making us safer. In fact, you could make a strong argument that prohibiting drugs, making drugs illegal, actually makes us less safe because it creates black markets, and with black markets come, you know, violence.
Yeah.
This is why homicide rates soared during alcohol prohibition and then dropped as soon as it was repealed. Absolutely. I wrote an article a couple of years ago for Huffington Post about this woman in Chicago who was severely beaten outside of a bar and could not get the Chicago Police Department to look into her case. She, you know, kept going back and back and back, and they kept putting her off, and they lost her file, and she ended up solving the crime on her own, basically, and finally she came in and said, here's the guy who did it, and a couple months later they arrested him on a separate charge and then charged him, you know, for her beating. So she couldn't get them to take any interest. About a year later, she and her boyfriend had brought in a house guest, basically a college friend of her boyfriend, who was either smoking or maybe had made a couple of, you know, small sales of marijuana from their apartment. And within a few days, they were raided by, I think it was a 12-member SWAT team, you know, broke down their door and, you know, just completely trashed their apartment and found, you know, basically a small baggie of pot. And it was such a stark illustration of how the drug war warped the priorities of police departments, where you had this woman who was a victim of an actual violent crime and couldn't get anyone at the Chicago Police Department to listen to her. But, you know, a house guest commits a couple of nonviolent consensual marijuana crimes, and they get raided by a full-on SWAT team.
Amazing. Amazing. And I got to mention, there was, you know, there's a lot of good police out there, really good civic-minded police, quite a few of them. And there was one that testified before the New Hampshire Senate who said he was a police chief, and he said that he considers every arrest to be a failure. And I thought, boy, now that's what we need, you know, instead of, you know, looking for action. Cause, you know, the cops' jobs can be pretty dull if, you know, things are going well. But, I wonder about, just in a minute or so we have left, what about, community policing? What does that mean? Can policing be redefined, and how might this be part of a solution?
Yeah, well, community policing is the idea that cops should be a part of the communities that they serve, and they should consider themselves a part of them. So they should walk beats, and they should, you know the names of the principals of the schools and on their beats. They should know the business owners and attend neighborhood meetings. And the idea is that if cops have a stake in these communities, that they feel like they're a part of them, when it does come time to use force, the community will see it as a police officer, one of their own, you know, using force to protect them, not as this outside entity that's being, you know, sort of imposed on them. And from a police officer standpoint, I mean, I think it would just make their jobs more pleasant. I mean, imagine if you're a cop and you're in your patrol car all day and the only interaction you have with other people is when you're confronting them and when there's, you know, negativity and confrontation. That's a pretty miserable experience, existence of day-to-day life, work life. So community policing is this idea that cops should ingrain themselves in the communities they serve, become a part of them, and then you'll have, you know, better relationships, and the cop community interactions won't be as antagonistic.
Wow. Very interesting. Very useful stuff. People can follow your stuff on Huffington Post, Radley Bulko. His book is Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces. Thank you so much for being with us. Very informative.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Police and Thieves, The Clash.
Guns and ammunition, police at the east.